Good morning. Oh, good afternoon. Yeah. Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Monday, January 31st, 2022. The time is 1:32 in the afternoon. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Full House today. Senators in attendance are Senator Keel, Senator Schauer, Senator Hughes, Senator Myers, and myself as Chair, Senator Holland. We do have a quorum to conduct business. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones if you have them on you. And thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Alex, our moderator for today. The first item on today's calendar is Senate Joint Resolution 19 related to a constitutional spending limit. This is the second hearing on this resolution. I'll remind the public that this committee previously worked extensively on this resolution back in September of 2021, including three committee hearings and passing seven amendments to the original draft. SCR 19 is identical to the resolution this committee completed and passed in September of 2021. Do members have any further questions for the sponsor of this bill? Senator Schauer.
Just a question briefly, if he could, we talked about this last year, but if he could just remind the committee through the rep and then himself that had taken this and kind of tweaked it, how we had talked about the trailing averages, how that impacts, could we just get a, because we didn't really get into that the other day because you wanted to kind of keep it moving, if we could just discuss that, because that was one of the big contentious points of how you, not only inflation and how things change, but what drives it, the indicators to it for that change in the spending cap, just because I think it's an important part of the consideration because we didn't have it the other day. If you could just rehash that for the record, I would appreciate it.
And I'll mention, because Senator Schauer is showing that we're following the Senate floor policy where if you want to remove your mask while you speak, you're welcome to. It improves the recording quality of this, but please stay masked beyond that. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the idea here is we there's a five-year rolling average laden into the average that we're using for the personal income index. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is to provide a little bit more stability as we're moving forward rather than having us jerk up and down on a regular basis. The other reason is because you would assume as if the state goes into a recession that we would actually need to ramp up a couple of pieces of our state spending relatively short term, such as unemployment insurance, a couple other things like that, to help compensate. And so giving us that rolling average means that the state economy can drop a little bit while that rolling average is still going up slightly. And that way we aren't cutting ourselves off immediately from additional state funding right at the time that we need it. We would know that in a couple of years, as that average moves forward, we would need to be knocking our spending down, but at the same time giving us a little bit of flexibility there at the beginning. So again, in my mind, that then gives the state a little bit more incentive to pay attention to the private sector and help get our economy back up and running if we do run into a recession.
Mr. Chair, two follow-ups.
Follow-up from Senator Schauer.
Very brief, Senator Myers. So this could, as we discussed previous versions of spending caps, lead us to a deflationary period. It could actually drive it down. And that is, I mean, based on your answer, that's I think, a yes. But if you could just expound, that would be great. Not a lot, but just from the showing people that could happen to the curve. And the second thing is where do we start from? Because that was always one of the questions. Do you know, where are you starting the curve, if you will, like from today? So it'd be like based on the current budget, and then it's an upward trend. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's all.
Senator Schauer, to answer your first question there, yes, it does put some downward pressure on the budget if the state goes through a little bit of a recession. Again, the concept of the cap is not only to cap our spending, but to tie it to the performance of the state as a whole, the state economy as a whole. We don't want those two to get out of balance. They're already somewhat out of balance, in my opinion, anyway. But we don't want that to be exacerbated. And then to answer your second question, as for the starting point, I believe that's one of the beauties of the way that this cap is constructed. Previous spending caps that have been proposed just take current spending and then index it by inflation or population or both. And that gets us into some significant problems, or it can get us into some significant problems in certain circumstances moving forward. And because it's not necessarily tied to what else is really going on, whether that's what's really going on with our state spending or what's really going on with our economy. Inflation is always an issue, but let's be honest, inflation is a driver that happens because of things that happen outside of Alaska. Population is an issue, but you would assume that population would also largely follow the economy. If the economy is doing great, more people come into the state. The economy is tanking, population goes with it. So I believe that by following the economy as a whole, and in this case we're using personal income as our statistic to stand in for the economy as a whole, then I believe that that provides a better tracking overall.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Myers. With no other questions for the sponsor, the Senate Judiciary Committee received one amendment on this bill from Senator Keel. Senator Keel, do you care to move your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Amendment 1, which is Mark A.1.
Is there an objection for discussion?
I'll object.
There's an objection for discussion. Senator Keel, would you care to explain your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would. The sponsor talked a little bit just a moment ago about the shift this committee made back in September from one marker of the economy to another. And in working with legislative finance and with the economist in your office, Mr. Chairman, it looks like we just need to make a slight adjustment to the maximum highest possible allowable percentage under this proposed constitutional amendment so that we have the kind of headroom that the sponsor talked about back in September. And I'll just draw members' memories back to those halcyon days of the fall when we had conversations about 14% of gross state product, leaving approximately in the neighborhood of $600 million of what they call headroom. And if you'll look back at the charts that we had just the other day on this version using personal income, 14% leaves us with pretty significantly less than that in terms of headroom. Just about $100 million in the current fiscal year and maybe $400 in the next. So going to 14.5 gets us to the level that we discussed when we moved this bill in September because we've changed economic indicators.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Is there any further discussion? Senator Hughes?
Yes, thank you. And just so I understand what you were talking, but I do have a question. I'm not sure if the sponsor of the bill itself or you would be the best one to answer this. And I am sorry to do this, but because we don't have a slide, but on this particular sheet that was provided us by the sponsor, the lower half, we see the constitutional amendment limit in blue. It looks like there's $100-200 million headroom from our high peaks of spending at the 14%. So is it correct that blue line would move slightly up with your 14.5%? And I guess that's a question for the amendment sponsor, Mr. Chair, and then if the bill sponsor wanted to say anything too.
I'll let the amendment sponsor, but do you have any input, or would you rather hear the bill sponsor first?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's our current status quo spending limit, but I'll look to the sponsor to confirm that that's the one we'd be replacing with the one in this bill.
Senator Myers.
Senator Keel is correct. That's the graph, Senator Hughes, that you're looking at there. That is the current spending cap, which was put in place back in the early 80s, and that's the reason that we're having this discussion is because of how big that gap is. It's an ineffective spending cap. It hasn't really applied basically since about the year after it was put in place. It potentially could have applied back during the last boom, about 2007, about 2012 offhand, but we're nowhere near that right now.
Okay, and if I would have put on my glasses and read the small print, I would have seen it. Just a friendly suggestion for future committee hearings, you might want to put current constitutional appropriation, because since we're talking SJR 19 is constitutional. Well, I see you do have that at the top. Thank you. I just wanted to see, so for sure we'd be below, whether we go with 14 or 14 and a half, we are below those high peaks had it been instituted. Yes, and that's what your top one is.
Through the chair, to Senator Hughes, if you check the next graph that's got the orange on that page there, yes, we are the high points that we hit there in FY09 and FY13 would be significantly above what we're proposing with this spending cap.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Thank you, Senator Myers. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. It might be different people want to answer them, but I'll just throw them out there. First thing, if they could just confirm, and I know we discussed this before, so I'm pretty sure of the answer, but I always like to hear it. If I take that orange chart, which is the one we were just discussing, the third chart of those two pages, what that means to me, had we had this, all of that money, not all, because there's capital spending and other things with that, but a good portion of that would have been saved and would still be probably in the permanent fund where we would have it under investments, et cetera. So that's one part of this, just discussing, I believe it was your staffer, Mr. Chair, that had told us in a briefing that we would have somewhere around maybe 115 to even a high of 130 billion in the fund had we not been spending this money. It would have been a lot extra that we would have been forced to. The second thing, for those that are concerned of that, you would have had a true downward pressure on the budget as opposed to just being able to spend and grow government and the other kinds of things. And I'm not saying it's all bad. I'm just highlighting. That's what I understand looking at this. I want to confirm that, one. And then the second question is definitely for the amendment maker, and it may or may not be, but what would the line look like at 14.5% on that chart? And do you know, Senator Keel, what that – I know I'd asked you what the percentage would be when the current one. Would it be a 20% spending limit? We're going to 14.5, or is it 25? Does anybody know that answer? I'm just curious to give me some numbers to hang my hat on. Those are the two kind of questions. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Schauer.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, rolling question. So, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So two parts there. I can't make Senator Schauer a promise about what past legislatures would have done. Might have been a higher balance in the permanent fund. Might have been a higher balance in the CBR statutory budget reserve. But I think the chart that he refers to, the orange bars with the blue line, indicates that there would have been a lot of unspent. In prior years. As far as what the 1980s era amendment would look like in terms of percent of personal income, round figures, it's at about 10 billion now. So if this limit would be at just a little over 5 billion now, I would suggest that it's in the neighborhood of 25% of personal income, ballpark.
Okay. Doing some rough math.
That is rough math, and I'll look to the sponsor of the underlying bill to see if I'm way, way off.
Senator Myers?
I believe Senator Keel is correct. We didn't run that on this one with the personal income. I do remember that we ran that question back in August when we were talking about 14% of GDP, and that the current spending cap, I believe, was – I'm wanting to say it was about 23% of GDP. So roughly ballpark figure, yes.
And I'll remind the committee that we are the Judiciary Committee, and we discovered judiciary policy, discussed judiciary policy, and I'm sure finance is going to have their own when they weigh in on the appropriateness of 14 or 14.5%.
Can we take an at ease, please, Mr. Chair?
Brief at ease. Senate Judiciary Committee is back on the record. Senator Hughes, did you want to put that question on the record?
Yeah, I was just going to say I was a little bit confused by the chart, but it got clarified. And so right now we're looking at, based on the appropriation proposed for this budget we are currently working on, this gives about, looks about $500 million headroom at the 14%. Is that correct? A little less than $500 million?
Senator Myers, care to answer that one?
Yeah, Senator Hughes, so with the budget that is that was currently proposed by the governor, I'm looking at $467 million for headroom right now.
Thank you.
Is there any further discussion on this amendment? Seeing Senator Schauer. Yeah,
just a comment, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I appreciate what the sponsor is doing, and quite frankly, I don't mind the wiggle room to go to 14.5 versus the 14. And if I was confident that that's where it was going to stay, I would actually have no problem voting for this. My concern and really my questions were germane to the next committee a referral, where we see things happen, that we lose control over that. And so my concern with this is not his, because I can agree to this, and I see the good reason for it. I'm concerned what they will potentially do, which is why I struggle with an increase one, because I feel we're going to see that anyways, knowing who is there and what's likely to happen. So I'm just saying this for the record, that it's not that I disagree necessarily with doing it, but I am concerned that this grows higher in a place that we maybe don't want it to be. And so that's why this is going to be a tough one for me to vote on, not because I don't appreciate what he's doing, because I actually do. So I just want to throw that out there. Thank you.
Senator Hughes.
Yeah, and I wanted to come in with this open mind. In fact, first I thought, no, I'm going to object and maintain my objection. And I thought I'll listen to the debate. And as I started listening to the debate, maybe so. But now that I realize this is already a half of a billion headroom, and I understand in out years that changes, but there are a lot of things that change in out year as far as the economy, as far as inflation, all kinds of things. So I am actually comfortable with it being at 14%, and so I will be maintaining my question, my objection when you ask that question.
Ruin the suspense.
Yeah.
All right. Any further discussion?
Very quick wrap-up.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a reminder to the members of the committee that the way that the underlying constitutional amendment is structured, a bill enacted into law, governor's signature and all, not an appropriations bill, can set our functional spending limit anywhere lower than the number we put into this. So we don't have to keep headroom. What this number does, it is the absolute hard ceiling thou shalt never break. And so I think that's a reason to set this with a little bit of space, as we discussed in September.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Hughes, do you maintain your objection?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Madam Secretary, would you please call the roll?
No.
Senator Hughes. No.
Senator Myers. Yes.
Senator Keel.
Yes.
Yes. With a vote of three yeas and two nays. Glad I was counting. With a vote of three yeas and two nays, Amendment 1 is adopted. Are there any further amendments? With no further amendments, at this point we'll go to public testimony. And so I'll now open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who cares to present public testimony? And I don't see anyone in the room interested in presenting public testimony. I'll look online. It appears maybe Mr. Edward Martin in Kenai. If you can hear me, please state your name and your affiliation and your location and begin your public testimony. Shoot for about 3 minutes or less, please.
Thank you, Chairman Holland. This is Ed Martin Jr. I'm currently at my winter residence in Hawaii, although I am a Alaska resident, and I have a home in Kenai on 702 Lawton Street. This is an interesting bill, and it's a bill that moves forward a constitutional amendment for which we all know will have to go in front of the people. There's something about this, I'm a little bit, maybe it can be explained in the committee a little bit deeper. But I always thought, as an American citizen, I am secure in my person, my papers and effects. Now, how is it that this bill could not or could be crafted in such a fashion that we can be secure in our income information? Because currently the state of Alaska has basically no information on me or anyone else because we don't do income tax. Will you guys be using the federal tax rolls in order to spy on us as to what we pay in income so you can establish a budget? I think this is when I started to read through the sponsor statement, and Senator Myers, I have deep respect for your concern about the budget and appropriations and spending. But I can tell you, I could think of much better constitutional amendment that actually holds the legislature and the administration to following the law and the statutes thereof. I would feel a lot better if this is what you were bringing forward. Now, as far as my feelings about a lot of stuff that goes on in Alaska after 56 years of being a resident, yeah, I've got issues. And I'll be testifying on one of them this afternoon. It has to do with trading your permanent fund for some land. I hope you guys pay attention to that because that needs to get through the legislature. That's what creates new wealth. That's what stabilizes our economy and trying to get toward a more of a private-based economy instead of a government-based economy. The only reason a government would become or continue to be a government-based economy is because of spending. That's the only thing that keeps them in power. Now, you know, gee whiz, I know what you guys are trying to accomplish, but you know, you had a special committee that you allude to at the very end of this sponsor statement, Mr. Myers, and I'm of the aware that there was a 600-page audit of our finances, of which we got like 90 problems, conflicting statements. I would have hoped, and I asked my representative, Ben Carpenter, to bring that into that committee that was established last fall and discuss that. Because to be honest with you, I think what we need in state government currently is a complete audit of every department so that we can come to an understanding of what needs to be spent, and maybe even an revenues, because for whatever reason here, we're spending beyond our means, or have been until maybe this year, that I understand the governor's budget, it happens to be somewhat balanced. If you pay
Mr. Martin
pay us out in a dividend.
Mr. Martin, I'd like to get back to discussing the bill before us. You've reached the 3-minute mark. I do have an economist on the staff, Mr. Ed King. Mr. King, if you care to take the presenter's table and provide some insight on maybe some of the questions that Mr. Martin had.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ed King, staff, Senator Garland. Mr. Chairman, just real briefly, not to belabor the point, but there are federal metrics that are provided publicly through the Bureau of Economic Analysis. Those are the numbers that we've used to generate the charts that you're looking at. It's the expectation. If it's the committee's expectation and the legislature's expectation that we'd be using that federal data, it is available. And even without a personal income tax, that information is available through the IRS and made public.
Thank you, Mr. King. Next up is Mr. Mike Coons. Mr. Coons, if you can hear me, please state your name, your affiliation, and your location, and begin your presentation, your 3 minutes of testimony.
Thank you, Senator Holland and members. My name is Mike Coons. I'm from Holler, and I'm speaking for myself. Senator Myers was talking about a little bit earlier the rolling average and that how that if we would go into a recession, we would have to be able to make adjustments. I thought on that one is, well, isn't that what we had a well-funded state guard for? Which is what we have now, which is basically dip. I think it was what, $15 billion we had in CPR that was for at the end of the day, that recession. So I'm thinking with if we actually go back to what the original thought was, governor of the 2.5 versus what statute now or in the Constitution now of a 10% cap, then we would have more money that we would be able to put into that CDR, build that CDR, and if we did have a recession later on down the line, we needed to defend that and do absolute real function of government, not additional social welfare or spending, would be able to do that. Reading this as a voter, I would be confused. Confused voters vote no, much less this is at 14% versus 2.5. If we were to have an amendment, governor's amendment, or governor's constitutional amendment, I want a clear-cut 2.5% cap. Let the voters decide as that's what we want. So what I'm reading is I do not support this, and I do support the governor's constitutional amendment of 2.5% max.
Mr. Coons, did you complete your testimony?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thanks so much. I didn't know if it just kind of broke off kind of quick there.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Could he repeat his last sentence because it broke off? I'm not sure I caught his final statement.
Mr. Coons, did you hear that? If you would repeat your last sentence.
Yes. My closing was we want a clear-cut 2.5% cap and let the voters decide that's what we want. So what I'm reading is I do not support this bill and do support the governor's constitutional amendment 2.5% appropriation gap. Thank you.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coons, I've got a question for you as well. I'm not entirely sure what you're getting at. We ran through the governor's cap in this committee last year as well. The governor's cap, from what I remember, didn't have a percentage in it. So I'm not sure what the 2.5% that you're alluding to is and what it's a percentage of.
That was my understanding when that was proposed by the governor, and that's what we were getting in the media with the 2.5. That's where I'm basing that at.
I just want to let everybody know, this is Mr. Coons' public testimony. He's just come out in the record that he doesn't support this bill. So, but Senator Hughes.
Right. And this is just, this could be, I could hold off until part of the discussion before we move forward, but, or I can do it now.
Go ahead. Go for it.
I just want to make it clear to the public that we're not talking about 2.5% compared to 14% or 14.5% now that it's been amended, because these are structured totally differently. So just so the public understands, we're not saying, let's say, for instance, the governor did support a 2.5% each year of growth. We're not saying 14.5% of growth. That's not what this means. And I don't know if the bill sponsor would like to explain that better than I can, but I think there could be some confusion.
Senator Myers, you care to offer any input?
Just a quick summary again. The difference between this cap and the governor's cap. The governor's cap, it took the current spending and then indexed it to inflation and population growth, so that as the population grew or as an inflation went up, then the amount that we would be allowed to spend as the legislature would grow. This is what I'm proposing here is a different mechanism. Rather than simply taking our current spending and moving forward with it, what I am suggesting is that our spending should reflect our economy. And so the 14% isn't a measure of growth. It's a measure of how much of our economy would be allowed to come from the government. So that if our economy shrank, our budget would shrink as well. If our economy grew, our government would grow. And again, as I explained in our initial presentation last week, that's to some extent the point. You expect need for a number of services to grow as the economy grows. So while the goal of both is the same, to limit spending to limit the excess if we ever have another boom year. The mechanism by which that happens is very different.
And if I thank you, Senator Schauer, if I could elaborate on that. So if the economy shrinks, the state spending would be, there'd be downward pressure on it to shrink. As the economy would grow, there would be more opportunities for state spending to increase. It wouldn't be tied into it automatically. It would just increase the cap.
Right.
Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, and I just want to make a comment because, I mean, it is conceivable that you could have your economy shrink and your population could grow and inflation could be up. But, and we don't want to be in a spot where we can't afford the government. And that's why this tying to the economy, I think, is actually a better mechanism than tying to population growth and inflation. Thank you.
With no more public testimony waiting in line, with no one else wishing to speak in the room, public testimony is now closed. And is there any further debate on this bill? Senator Myers, do you have any closing remarks on your resolution?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep it brief. Again, the point of spending cap is not to put downward pressure when we're already in a budget crisis. The point of a spending cap is to, and Senator Schauer alluded to this a little bit earlier, is to limit the growth and limit the excess spending later, because it's, as we've discovered multiple times in the legislature, that it's very easy to expand your spending. It's a whole lot harder to cut it back down again later. So if you're worried about having to cut your spending, it's best to keep it from going up in the first place. And as Senator Schauer mentioned, we did the math on it last year back when we first introduced this to GDP. We figured even without dealing with inflation or investment, that we would have had about an extra $15 billion in the bank, give or take. We didn't go back and rerun those calculations once we switched to personal income, but it probably would have been something similar. So as we move forward, this is definitely a significant part of our fiscal solution, is making sure that whatever revenue comes into the state, that we're not going on a spending spree again.
Thank you, Senator Myers. With no further discussion, Senator Schauer, I look to you for the will of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that SJR 19, Work Order 32-LS1353/alpha, as amended, be reported from the Senate Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Without objection, Senate Joint Resolution 19 has been reported from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. A brief at ease, sign the paperwork. On the record, next item on the agenda is House Bill 155 related to court-appointed visitors and experts. We'll bring House Bill 155 before the committee. This is the first hearing of HB 155 in Senate Judiciary, although it was scheduled for last Friday but not heard. Representative Tuck, welcome to Senate Judiciary. Would you put yourself and we'll introduce yourself and your staff and put yourself on the record and introduce your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for hearing House Bill 155 today. For the record, my name is Representative Chris Tuck from South Central Anchorage, the Diamond Business District, and with me is my staff, Mike Mason. And I would also like to thank the committee members for allowing me to present today.
Please proceed.
Thank you. House Bill 155 is a collaborative effort between the executive branch and the judicial branch, basically to fix a flaw in state law that hampers a good program's effectiveness. That program is the Alaska Court Visitor Program. And now a legislative branch is getting involved to help fix this program. House Bill 155 seeks to transfer the Alaska Court Visitor Program from the Office of Public Advocacy to the Alaska court system. Just as simple as that. One's in the executive branch, of course, one's in the judicial branch. Currently, OPA, the Office of Public Advocacy, is required by law to provide court visitor services. A court visitor is a neutral person with specialized training or experience that acts as an investigative arm of the Alaska court system in certain protective probate proceedings. Court visitors conduct independent investigations and make recommendations into whether guardianships or conservatorships are necessary. And just a quick reminder, guardianships are used to protect individuals who cannot care for their well-being due to incapacity or disability. And conservatorships, if I can speak, are used to manage an impaired person or minor's financial and personal affairs. So the court visitors also participate in psychotropic medication proceedings during involuntary commitments to investigate whether the patient can give or withhold informed consent. So currently, the fundamental inefficiency within the court visitor program is the state law gives the Office of Public Advocacy the responsibility of providing court visitors and guardianships and involuntary medication proceedings. We don't know why that got established that way. It's been like that since 1984. Prior to 1984, the court system was involved with these with the court visitor program, but just when the law was written for the Office of Public Advocacy, it was stuck in there. The Alaska court system contracts and pays for the court visitor program during these conservatorship proceedings. And so what we hope to do with House Bill 155 is solve this inefficiency by basically transferring the entire Alaska court visitor program into the Alaska court system. And I just want to add that we do have some invited testimony. We have the Alaska court system, who supports 155, Doug Woolover, the Deputy Administrative Director for the Alaska Court System, here to testify, as well as we have James Stinson with us as well, who oversees the he's the Executive Director for the OPA program.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. Mr. Mason, would you care to walk us through the sectional?
Yes, Mike Mason, staff to Rep. Hurst Tuck. So House Bill 155, an act relating to court-appointed visitors and experts relating to the powers and duties of the Office of Public Advocacy, relating to the powers and duties of the Alaska court system, and then providing an effective date. Section 1 repeals and reenacts AS 13.26.226D to read, the Alaska court system shall provide visitors and experts in guardianship proceedings under AS 13.26.291, the Alaska court system may contract for services of court-appointed visitors and experts. In Section 2, it amends AS 13.26.291A to stipulate that the Alaska court system shall bear the cost of the visitors and experts appointed under AS 13.26.226C. Section 3 amends AS 44.21.410A to remove paragraph 2 and then renumbers the remaining paragraphs. Section 4 amends AS 21.420C to remove language allowing the Commissioner of Administration to contract for services for court visitors and experts to perform the duties set out in AS 44.2140. And then Section 5 amends AS 44.21440B to remove a reference to court visitors from language prohibiting the Office of Public Advocacy from using improper pressure to influence the professional judgment of a person paid by the office. Section 6 amends AS 0.30.839D to remove language allowing the court to direct the Office of Public Advocacy to provide a court visitor to investigate whether a patient can give or withhold informed consent in psychotropic medication proceedings during involuntary commitments. Section 7 amends 47.30.839 to add a new subsection to read, the Alaska court system shall provide visitors in proceedings under this section. The Alaska court system may contract for services of court-appointed visitors. Section 8 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska to add transition language stipulating that the act applies to guardianship proceedings under AS 13.26291, and proceedings under AS 30.3839 commenced on or after the effective date of the act. The section further amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska to ensure that the Office of Public Advocacy shall provide visitors and experts in guardianship proceedings and visitors in proceedings under AS 47.30.839 that were commenced before the effective date of the act. And then Section 9 provides an effective date. And then we have as invited testimony today, we have the Deputy Administrative Director for the Alaska Court System. I believe Doug Woolver is on the phone. And then James Stinson is the Director of the Office of Public Advocacy, and he is on Microsoft Teams.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. I'll invite y'all to just maintain your location because no invited testimonies in person, so we won't need the table for right now. And we'll go to the invited testimony to see if, maybe provide more information before we get more questions. So first up is Doug Wolliver, Deputy Director, Alaska Court System. He's on the phone. Mr. Wolliver, if you can hear me, please state your name, your affiliation, your location, and begin your invited testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Doug Wolliver, Deputy Administrative Director for the Alaska Court System, and I'm calling in from my isolating spot in my apartment in Juneau. The court system and the Office of Public Advocacy have worked on this issue off and on for many years, and the court is in agreement with OPA that this is a change that makes sense. The court visitors are really, as the sponsor stated, they're really a court function. They serve as experts for the courts. And for some odd reason, they were placed in OPA statute decades ago. It's never really made a lot of sense, but it becomes a bigger and bigger issue as more and more people need protective services over the years. As you know, there's what's coming called the gray tsunami. As baby boomers age, number of protective proceedings, which frequently include people needing guardianships because of old age, those numbers are going to have been increasing and will continue to increase. And it makes sense to move court visitors from OPA to the court. What this bill does is just basically transfer that responsibility to us. We already have court visitors in conservatorship cases, which is, when someone needs money, help just with their money. And it's always been an odd split. This is just kind of a good government cleanup. They say we've talked about this for years. I think the first time I remember getting involved with it was during the Murkowski administration, when we were looking at ways to clean up statutes in some other ways. And the then director, Josh Fink, called and said, this is one of the areas we should work on. So now, years and years later, it looks like we are. So it's a good bill. Everybody's, OPA supports it. We support it. The court visitors support it. Are the people who already work for the court in this area support it. It's just a better way to manage people who actually do their work for the court system, but say are oddly positioned in the executive branch. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, but in general, it's a good bill. It cleans up an odd quirk in the statutes, and I think it'll be better if it's fixed.
Thank you, Mr. Wolliver. Next up will be James Stinson. Mr. Stinson, I see you on Teams. If you please state your name, your affiliation, and your location, and begin your invited testimony.
Thank you. So my name is James Stinson. I'm the director of the Office of Public Advocacy. I largely echo the sentiments of Mr. Wolliver. This has been a legislative oddity for quite some time. It's difficult to suss out what the exact genesis was, other than the notion that because OPA directly handles guardianships, I think at the time the legislature decided, well, this has to do with guardianships, we'll just put it with OPA. But at that point, it created a very strange split because, as you've already heard, the court system deals with conservatorship cases. And the work that a court visitor does between those two is really substantially the same. They're reporting directly to the court. They act as a neutral investigator. They're not advocates, yet they were placed with the Office of Public Advocacy. So there's even been a previous legislative audit. Don't quote me, but I believe it was sometime in the 2000s, perhaps the early 2000s, that basically made all these same arguments, that made the recommendation that the program should probably be transferred fully to the court system. One of the issues that legislative audit talked about was sort of the perception of a potential conflict with OPA. I don't know that there is an actual conflict with OPA handling the court visitor program for guardianships. But something to keep in mind is that the Office of Public Advocacy operates as multiple independent law firms under one umbrella. So when you go to one of these guardianship respondent proceedings, OPA is really providing all the parties. So on the court paperwork, you'll see that the court visitor is from OPA. You'll see that the expert is from OPA. Now, we're just paying for these services. They're not in-house. but still. And then you'll see that the respondent attorney that's supposed to argue on behalf of the person who might be having their liberty restricted also says OPA. You might have a guardian ad litem attorney that also says OPA. So one of the side effects of this has been a unfortunate public perception sometimes. And you can imagine that, especially if somebody is already somewhat diminished, right? And they're being faced with potential liberty restriction and they see OPA, 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 OPA. It looks almost like OPA is exerting, you know, full complete control over these proceedings, when the reality is these are all independent professionals. And the reality is the court visitor is directly beholden to the court and not OPA administration at all. So that would be one of the ancillary benefits of changing this, is solving that perception. So these arguments that we're making, they're not new. It's an old issue. And I think this legislation would really be a win-win-win to finally get it through, because it's going to increase efficiency. Because no matter how much OPA communicates with the court system, they're going to better manage their own arm. There's just no way around that. They're going to be able to set standards of practice. They're going to be able to train judges with court visitors. They're going to be able to say, this is what we want in a court visitor report to help convince us that we either need to substantially restrict someone's financial liberty or impose a full guardianship on somebody, which is the highest form of liberty restriction. So these are important proceedings, and it's really imperative that this program is managed effectively and efficiently. It's just due to the structural issues. That's just not something OPA can do well. It's something that the court system can do well. And as it's dropped off the radar year after year, I think it's finally come to a head just because of the program's growth. And when I say program's growth, it's essentially what Mr. Wolver had previously stated, which is just that as there's an aging demographic, as there's more and more guardianship proceedings, it becomes more and more unwieldy to have this awkwardly placed in the executive branch when it belongs in the judicial branch. So I think efficiency is gained. I think ultimately the court system will be better stewards of the money. This is a mandated service. The legislature has determined it's an important service, so we have to provide these services. And that raises the question, who can do it better? And admittedly, that's the court system. I think we've just hit a point of growth in this program where it's difficult for OPA to hobble along. At this point, if we were going to try to continue to manage the program, we would be asking for increased resources. And again, I still think we'd be doing it more poorly than the court system.
Thank you, Mr. Stinson. Having completed invited testimony, I'll ask if there's any questions from the committee for the sponsor or the testifiers. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the initial presentation, and I think was echoed in all the invited testimony as well, was that this was an efficiency cleanup, which I can see that in theory, but what's throwing me off is I'm looking at the fiscal notes that came with this, and I know how much you love to talk about the fiscal situation here in our Judiciary Committee. But I'm noticing that the court system is asking for about $100 million a year more than what the $100,000. Got to switch bills, got to switch my frame of reference here. About $100,000 more than what OPA would be not spending. And so I'm just curious as to what's causing the discrepancy there.
Representative Tuck, or
I'll deal with my staff.
Who's taking it?
I was actually going to turn to Mr. Wolver, because I know the OPA and the court system have actually worked together on the transition plan, and I think they can clarify that for you. So, Mr. Wolver.
Mr. Wolver, if you can hear us, please state your name and your affiliation again. Put yourself back on the record and provide any insight.
Yeah, this is Doug Wolver, Deputy Administrative Director for the Alaska Court System. As Mr. Stinson noted, the growth of this program is such that even if this program were to stay with OPA, they too would need to hire a person to oversee it. This person will coordinate all the various OPA contracts, all the appointments, schedule the training, help establish the training. These are things that need to be done for a program that has grown to the size that it is. And as Mr. Stinson says, and it will continue to grow. So whether this program stays with OPA or moves to the court, it still will require a staff person to help oversee it.
Thank you, Mr. Wolver. I saw Senator Hughes, you had a question.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for bringing this forward. I get the efficiency and that, but it makes me wonder back when this established whether it was a bit of a check and balance between branches of government. even though the courts, I believe, always took care of the conservatorships. But what I'm wondering, so what the testimony I've heard so far is that this is makes things more efficient, and that there's support from OPA, there's support from courts. Everybody that works in the courts supports this. But what I haven't heard and what I was hunting for was support from those that might represent the people who might be served by the court visitors. So when we talk about the aging population, I'm wondering about the Commission on Aging, AARP, AMAC, whether they support this. I can see where it might make the workplace function more smoothly, but what about how the regular Alaskans are served when they come to the court? Is this better for them? And have we heard from anyone representing the people rather than representing the court, whether executive or judicial branch?
I see Mr. Stinson, did you want to take a shot at this one? Please state your name, put yourself on the record.
Yeah, so for the record, this is James Stinson, Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. And to Senator Hughes's concern, you know, I can speak somewhat anecdotally on that. What I can say is, as previously stated in my testimony, there is a perception right now that OPA essentially has a sort of too much power or too much influence over the proceedings, because the court paperwork indicates that we are the ones providing the court visitor services. The only complaints I've received are from the notion that we are essentially controlling all the parties, or that's what the appearance is. So the previous legislative audit highlighted that as sort of a tension, and that we are providing the respondent counsel. So we're providing the attorney that might be arguing for that person who doesn't want a conservatorship and doesn't want a guardianship. We're providing the attorney that might be saying they don't need that, they shouldn't get that. But on the paperwork, we're also funding the court visitor whose independent recommendation, or he or she, their independent recommendation might be, no, this person really needs a conservatorship. This person really needs a guardianship. So I think it's actually, on the contrary, to have OPA provide both those services does at least provide a perception of a conflict. Again, I'm obviously not getting involved at the administrative level in that, but the perception of a conflict is in the status quo. And so changing that would actually help sort of clarify more that this really is just an independent investigator who's beholden to the court and who's designed to be a neutral person.
Just thank you for that, Mr. Chair. Oliver? I just want to say, I understand that conflict, Mr. Stinson. What I want to see is support coming from either individual Alaskans or groups that maybe represent these Alaskans, and perhaps that's something the sponsor can provide when we have public testimony or whatever. I'm not opposed to the bill. I just want to make sure they've had a chance to review it, because at this point it sounds like something where those working in the court system and with the court systems have decided this is a good shift. And I just like to know that the people that will be impacted by it will also support it.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Schauer? Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have a response?
Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. I will definitely reach out to the Alaska Commission on Aging and some others. I have sent this to, I believe I even sent it to the Alaska Commission of Aging and several other entities, kind of asking for feedback. And I've received no negative feedback so far. No one has said that they want the program to stay in OPA. As far as I can tell, everybody seems to be in broad agreement that this should happen. But I'll definitely reach out to some other entities and get you some feedback.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hughes took away one of my questions, so slightly shorter list. I'll rip through them quickly for time. I know you're tight. The oversight, then, is just us, and from the legislative perspective, this is really going to be budget, correct? If you were to say there was an oversight from us looking at this, the budgetary aspect?
Bill passes from here on out. Representative Tuck, for the record. Yes, that's correct.
As we talked about guardianship versus conservatorship, good luck saying that one. I know three times real fast. Is there any reason, based on the type of cases you have before to today, that you would want to split those up as opposed to keeping them as a combined? It sounds like you're making it almost like a combined category. Is there a reason that you might want to keep one with OPA and then the other one go? Or it almost sounds like OPA is just ready to ditch it. Is there any reason to split those up that would be an advantage, or keeping them together, is that just the thing now? But probably Mr. Stinson and two more, and they're quick.
Mr. Stinson?
Yeah, for the record, this is James Stinson, Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. So, Senator Schauer, the work that the court visitors do on either case are largely the same, and there is some back and forth. For example, you might have someone who is dealing with an issue that at a certain time just needs a conservatorship, and then as they continue to sort of lose capacity, they might then need a full guardianship. In rare instances, you might have someone who has, say, a traumatic brain injury, need a full guardianship, but they improve to the point of only needing a conservatorship. And so that's kind of part of why it doesn't make sense to house this in two different agencies, and that largely the work and the overlap is substantially similar. So there's no advantage that I or anyone else can think of to splitting those duties when the court visitors that are being contracted to do the work are literally the same court visitors that would be doing either type of proceeding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. Thank you. So on page three, basically section five, it talks about the Office of Public Advocacy may not use improper pressure to influence, et cetera, et cetera. It may be in statute already, but we often see these things and say, don't do that, or I'm going to say, don't do that louder. Are there any penalties associated with it? Because when we codify these things, I like to know if somebody's going to do something wrong, what penalty do they face? What's the incentive to not do it? Do you know if that exists anywhere, or the sponsor, whoever?
So through the chair, Senator Schauer, I do not. I know that also applies to not interfering unduly with guardian ad litem and attorneys. In those two instances, it's a lot easier. I think historically, OPA has just erred on the side of caution because this is a judicial function. So it makes sort of heightens the tension with that clause, whereas it's a lot easier to understand under the rules of professional conduct, you know, what an attorney's duties are. Here, since we're sort of administering a function of the court, we don't have a lot of oversight or direct involvement in what court visitors do. But to answer your question, I don't know what the actual penalty would be.
Mr. Chairman, last one.
Last one.
Thank you for the patience. I'd like to know if I could get an answer on that, perhaps, if there's anything in statute. Chris, on that one. And then on page four, section seven, it says the Alaska court system shall provide visitors and proceedings under the section, but the court system may contract for services of court-appointed visitors. My question relates to funding. So if they decide not to, because it says may, not shall, are we going to be on the hook for more money? Because they're going to come back and say, well, we've got to process all these cases. We're going to need to increase what Senator Myers was talking about before. How's that going to work there? Because that seems to be a bit of a disconnect to me. And thank you for the time, Mr. Chair.
And through the chair, thank you for the question, Senator Schauer. Yes, it's going to be a year-to-year budget item. It will be. Based on need, based on demand. Someone said about the gray avalanche or the gray tidal wave, whatever happened to be. That's the first time I heard that. It's just a nature of people aging and needing more services such as this or any other type of disability or reasons to have this type of oversight. So, and I, just going back on that fiscal note a little bit, those budgets, a lot of budgets have been cut over the years. This is an opportunity to kind of bring the department where it needs to be with or without this bill. It's still going to have to happen. It just rather than doing a budgetary process, we have a fiscal note that combines with this because that's been negotiated between OPA and the court system right now where that number should be. And then falling back a little bit on the statutes and whether or not the penalty is written somewhere in statute, I believe it's not. Otherwise, we would have it spelled out in here. I'm going to have to look in a little bit deeper. But remember, the reason why that's in there in the first place is because OPA by nature is an advocacy group. So to make them neutral, those statutes had to be put in there. Those limitations on what they shall and shall not do had to be put in there because by nature they're advocacy. And in this case, they cannot be advocacy. They've got to remain neutral. Why it makes more sense to put it in the court system.
Mr. Chair, the question to that, what we will end up with, if it's a contract thing, that's one thing because you pay a contract, they can go away. You're not stuck with them. You can change it, cost, et cetera. But if we are growing a position or two, we're going to get stuck with that. That's going to be another state employee, retirement, or other things. I'm curious because that leaves that open and it's not codified. So I would like to get clarification or see what they're thinking. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. start with an ignorant question or two first, a little baseline understanding. These visitors and experts, do they remain with an Alaskan throughout their time having a conservatorship, throughout their time having a guardianship, throughout their time in the medical care system? Or are these really single reports that they are investigating, making to the court, and then they're gone?
Mr. Mason?
Mike Mason, staff to Rep. Tuck. I believe that Mr. Stinson can provide more more input there.
Mr. Stinson?
Yes, for the record, James Stinson, Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. So there's an initial proceeding, Representative Keel, and then there's what's called three-year reviews. So every 3 years, in order to make sure that this substantial imposition of liberty is still appropriate, they have to do a subsequent report, subsequent investigation, and build on that. So what you're seeing essentially is total guardian numbers go up, and then you'll hit cycles of three-year reviews, which will spike, and then you might get a couple dips, but then as the total amount of guardians go up, you'll get spikes again. So these are very much stacked costs. Part of that reason is guardianships, and to a lesser extent conservatorships, but also conservatorships, tend to remain for somebody's natural life. So you might have a severely disabled juvenile come out of the juvenile system, and they might live to be 80 under a full guardianship. So these cases really stick around. It's not like a criminal case or a civil case where you can say, well, you know, in a year or two, if somebody's found guilty, they're found not guilty, it's done. These tend to stick around for somebody's natural life, which is why you're seeing this consistent building of caseload.
Follow up from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then a question probably again for Mr. Stinson. As I look at the transition section here, are those three-year reviews new proceedings, or is that the same guardianship or conservatorship proceeding throughout that person's natural life?
So, through the chair, Senator Keel, I suppose it depends on how you want to conceive of it. I would say it's the same in the sense that it's still that person, if at all possible, it's the same court visitor who's doing those three-year reviews, but it's a new thing happening within that guardianship or conservatorship, if that makes sense.
It would be very helpful to me to get real clarity on that. If that remains the same proceeding for the transition section, we'll have two entities running this program for decades and decades and decades. If it is the three-year review is a new proceeding, we'll have not more than about 3 years of this transition period where both agencies run a piece of the program. So that'll be helpful to understand. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Mr. Stinson, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, through the chair. So the way the court system at OPA have agreed upon this with that effective date is that the services that took place before that date, we would finish paying for, and then the rest would transfer to the court system. Is how we're working that out between the respective agencies. I can clarify further. There's no in-house PCNs that provide these services. These are all independent contractors. So the money that we're transferring to the court system from OPA pays for independent contractors, the same independent contractors that the court system uses. So really, it's just an issue of who is paying the bill. And so we stop paying the bill on X date, and the court system takes over paying the bill on X date. I'm not in any way administering these proceedings. These are still being done by independent court visitors who are reporting to the court in either case. So it's an issue of when that fund, you know, transfer responsibility happens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll follow up with the sponsor to make sure that the language in this transition section of the bill, Section 8, matches with the intent.
Thank you, Senator Keel. With no other questions from the committee. Thank you, Representative Tuck. Thank you, Mr. Mason, the other testifiers today. We're going to now set House Bill 155 aside. A brief at ease. Judiciary is back on the record. At this time, we're gonna not visit with Senate Bill 129. We have some invited testimony standing by, and I'll just wave them off. Just let them know. Appreciate them staying tuned in. But we're gonna revisit that on Wednesday, I believe. At this time, the next item on the agenda is Senate Bill 119, related to oaths of office. We'll now bring Senate Bill 119 before the committee. I invite Senator Reinbold to take the presenter's table. This is the first hearing of Senate Bill 119 in Senate Judiciary Committee. It previously passed Senate Education Committee. Senator Reinbold, is your staff going to be doing the sectional? No, okay. Senator Reinbold, would please put yourself on the record and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate being before the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Senator Laura Reinbold, District G.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. Please begin your testimony.
Excellent. Well, as you know, the Constitution requires us to all swear to uphold and defend the Constitution and our oath of office as we are sworn in to serve the people of this great state. And what Senate Bill 119 does, it's a very, very basic bill, but it just requires anybody who's constitutionally required to take the oath to the state of Alaska Constitution and the United States Constitution to read, to make sure they read it first, read the Declaration of Independence, read the United States Constitution, and the Constitution of the state of Alaska prior to taking the oath. And following the reading of the documents, they sign a statement that says that they actually did do this and it is filed. And I can, when I get in the sectional, I'll be able to tell you where they're filed. So that's pretty much the bill.
Very simple. Do you care to walk through the sectional at this time?
I think it would probably help everybody if I did it because I can do it really fast. And so if you look at the sectional, the first part is just the fact that everybody reads those three documents. And this one, Section A, is just school board members. And then the next one is anybody appointed by the governor or any executive branch. The next one, and this is Section 3. This is before the Supreme Court justice. Section 4 would be the Court of Appeals judges. Section 5 would be the Superior Court judges. Section 6 is the District Court and magistrates. Section 7 is each member of the legislature. Section 8 is the principal executive officer of each department, obviously commissioners, et cetera, or board, you know, if they're appointed to the board. Section 9 is any public officer or employee of the state of Alaska. So these people are already required to do this. And the reason we brought this bill forth is we read the, like, how the judges, you know, are supposed to do this and how the legislature is supposed to do it and how the commissioners, and there was inconsistencies. So what this basically does is it's just a consistent process where it basically requires that they read them, but it just makes it more uniform.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's hard for me to imagine anybody swearing an oath to uphold the Constitution, the state, United States and the state without having read them, but I suppose it's possible. Why the Declaration? Why require reading the Declaration of Independence when the oath isn't to uphold the Declaration of Independence?
I think that's an absolutely fabulous question, and I'm really thankful that you brought it up. And I the reason why I think it's so pertinent right now is right now the executive branch, in my opinion, is way out of their lane, and they're writing mandates. And the legislative branch clearly is supposed to be the one writing the the laws. And the executive branch executes, obviously, you guys know this, and the judges, you know, if there's any disputes, it comes before the judicial branch. But when you go and you read the Declaration of Independence, you realize what our founding fathers, mothers, families were going through at the time and the grievances that they had toward tyranny. And just the grievances were just atrocious. And it just reminds people why, because it's actually, you know, it's so important. And then you go into the preamble and the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights protects us from a lot of those things that, of the grievances. And so they're coupled, they're married, and I think it's absolutely critical to read the Declaration and the Constitution together.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the more thorough exploration of the relationship between the branches and which branch shall have the lawmaking power and what the execution of the law really means in the executive branch is really best done. I saw a letter in the packet in the Federalist Papers. And I don't know about other members of the committee, but I got to read those in high school and then, of course, again in college. But is there a reason that we wouldn't require, if that's the goal, that thorough understanding of the relationship between the branches, why we wouldn't require reading Federalist?
Through the chair, I think that would be great. However, it's not part of this. People are welcome to do that on their own. If you want to make an amendment, I certainly won't object to that amendment. But I was just trying to make this, you know, where it already, you know, right now we have to take an oath to the United States Constitution and the state constitution, and the Declaration is just a perfect way to explain why that these got put into place. But I think it's great education to read the Federalist Papers as well. But right now, this bill is very, very simple. It got through two committees or three already. Anyway, it's flying through the committees, basically.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you said, it's been through a couple of committees. I saw it once already. The one thing I haven't figured out with this bill yet is what's the problem it's trying to solve?
Mm-hmm. So, through the chair, a lot of people, I think I would actually, if it were my choice, this is something I wanted to do in education, actually, is the students as well. I would love to see the students reading the Constitution and Declaration of Independence. I think we are on mission drift in this country. There's big things happening in this country right now, and I think it's so important for all of us to go and recognize and read it. I know every time I read it, and I try to keep this, you know, with me, even in committees and things like that, it is the supreme law of the land. People get caught up in policy. They get caught up in guidelines. They get caught up, you know, state statutes, all this kind of thing. But they need to go to the supreme law of the land, and that's the Constitution, and have a refresher in regards to making sure that people do recognize how important and how valuable and what is actually in these precious, precious documents, so they stay mission focused.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the problem, I think, comes not in not knowing them, but in the interpretation of them. Just for the Constitution, to the best of my knowledge, there's at least three schools of interpretation for the Constitution, and two of them, I think, we'd usually call conservative. So I just have to wonder if the issue here is knowledge or if the issue is just interpretation.
Through the chair,
Senator Reinbold.
I do not believe that people need to interpret, you know, the most basic things. Basically, the Constitution was put in place to keep the government in its lane, to keep the government constrained, and ensure that the people know what exactly their rights are. We're the most amazing country with the longest standing Constitution. So, you know, when people need to understand what an inherent right is, what the source of government is, it says, all political power is inherent in the people. All government originates with the people. It's founded upon their will only and is instituted solely for the goal of the people. Things like that, it's just really important to know. Civil rights, freedom of religion, no law shall be made respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise of. I don't need someone really to interpret that. I think this was written for all people of Alaska to be able to read and appreciate themselves. So I just think all elected officials, it's a good reminder to me, I try to on the Constitution Day every year to read the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the state constitution. And every time it's just, I'm like, oh, wow, that's really cool. You know, it's just a good, really super good refresher. But I think people need, if they're going to take an oath to something, it's nice to have it documented that they actually read them.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senator Ramble, you know, philosophically, I agree with this. Actually, it's interesting. Senator Keel said it. You know, he learned this in social studies. I wish that this is more of the thing that we teach today, because I think that's actually the foundational purpose. If you don't know where you came from, you don't know how you got here, and you don't know where you're going, and they're guiding principles. And you don't necessarily have to like it or even agree with it. You may have a different take as a person learning those documents, and that's fine, but you still need to understand them and how the country got where we are, because there's a great misunderstanding, in my opinion, of what we are today, because we're a democracy. No, we're really not. We're a representative republic with democratic flavor thrown in. So it goes back to his comment, which I agree with. I wish we just make this a back to social studies and has to be taught. And I like the concept of saying that's something that you actually should do. If you're going to represent the people, then you ought to understand the documents that guide us. So I think it's an interesting concept. I wish we could expand it. I have read the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers. There's a lot of interesting discussion there. Maybe he'll make an amendment on that one. But I guess my point goes back to the only struggle I have with it, not because I don't think it's a good idea, because I agree, is, and this may be just something that you have thought of that you could give us, and this is really my question, will this run into any kind of a challenge from the courts, do you think, or have you thought about it? Because it gets tenuous sometimes when we tell somebody they must do something, they shall. You take an oath of office, we all do that, that's a shall, we shall take it, so it's probably okay. I was just curious on this one, because like I said, we get back into the back to the freedom side of it, or can we really demand somebody to read all these different documents before it runs into somebody saying, I'm not going to do that, and we have a problem with this. So just, I'm curious how you wargamed that out and thought about it, and that was all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Schauer.
So the reason why I actually brought this bill forth is because I was just trying to figure out, my mic, oh, there it is, it's back on. Basically, it was not exactly consistent between the judges, between, they have to take an oath already. So all the judges, the Court of Appeals, the magistrates, the commissioners, you know, everybody's already required, but there was just inconsistency in the state statutes of how exactly that was done. So I can't imagine anybody not being required to read these before they take an oath, because then they don't even know what they're taking an oath to. So I personally can't see that at all, you know, that being a friction or a in any way, personally. I mean, I understand what you're saying in regards to that, but if they're going to take an oath, they better know what's in these documents if they're going to swear to uphold and defend them. How can you uphold and defend something if you haven't read them?
Follow up.
It doesn't take that long to read them.
No, don't misunderstand. Like I said, I'm not against it. I actually think it's something that people should do. It was just a question, have you heard of or talked about or legal opinion, anything that said that? And I would just want to give one brief example, and I'm done, is that talking to, when I did my little research project about the Pioneer Caucus, not to go down that rabbit hole, but one of the state senators I talked to, I forget the state, it might have been Missouri, Mississippi, one of them, they actually have something in there that goes even farther with what you can and can't do, because it talks about, you know, promising your vote. It's actually in there, which is something we do under the binding rule, and so there's even more than just an oath to the office. It actually specifically talks about actions you can and cannot take in this particular case, like voting for or against the bill, and I forget the exact wording at this point, but I just thought it was interesting, and I appreciate you taking time to answer, because sometimes we find when we do these things, there's an unintended consequence or some court case, and it's an issue. So thank you for that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Hughes?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually like it, and I know that every time you read it, you actually something else pops out at you. And it's just like even watching a movie you watched a long time ago, you notice something different. It's always good to read it. And I actually, when I decided I was going to run for office, before I filed, I did a review of all those because it had been since high school, maybe touched on a little bit in college. And in having a conversation with other people that were candidates after we filed, a couple of them in a conversation admitted they needed to go back and read it. They filed without reading it. So I am sure, I'm very sure that there are people that will take the oath of office that haven't read them since high school, or maybe they were absent the day it got discussed in high school. So I think it's a great requirement. And because this went through the education committee, school board members got added. assembly members, community council members didn't get added. So I'd like the sponsor's opinion of that. And then as far as the Federalist Papers, if there are cliff notes on that, I wouldn't mind. But I think the Federalist Papers run 250, 300 pages. The Anti-Federalist Papers, I'm not sure. It's 85 essays in Federalists, 15, 16, the Anti-Federalists. That's a lot of requirement. But if there's cliff notes, I'd be open to an amendment for that. But I just wondered what you thought about assembly members and city council members.
Senator Reingold.
Okay, you're talking to me. Okay, so I wasn't sure if you were. They are included on here under municipal, I believe.
You're speaking towards school board and assembly?
Yes. I believe it was I believe it was your amendment, Senator Hughes, in education, and then we filed it with the municipal clerk instead of SLAMS because it was this state libraries and museums where it was filed, but then you wanted it to go to the municipal clerk.
This is just the first hearing of the bill, too, so we'll have time to explore that answer.
Follow-up, is that in Section 9, then? Would we just say public officer or employee, maybe?
Section 10.
Every
Section 10. Oh, you know what? I'm missing Section 10. Thank you. Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to prepare the cliff notes for Senator Hughes, as long as I get to do the glossing and the cliff notes and the interpretation. I'm perfectly happy to do it. I think Section 1 of this bill gets to school board members in Title 14. I think Section 8 of the bill gets to council and assembly members in Title 29. That's our local government chapter. I guess the question I had for the bill sponsor, though, you mentioned filing these oaths of office, which I assume is done now. The question, I guess, would be as to the consequences of someone who didn't do the required reading. Is that a disqualification to continue to hold the office? I guess it goes back to the question that Senator Schauer asked a different person on a previous bill. What is the consequence?
This is on the honor system. I mean, that when they take an oath, they sign that they've read it. And I just think that the reason why we're filing is to say you did read it and you need to be held accountable for the contents, you know, in which they already have to swear to hold and defend. But that's the bottom line. If people want to go and say, hey, did they actually, there's actually just a copy with their signature file. But it is on the honor system. We're not going to sit there and have them read it out loud to us if that's what you're asking.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Reingold, Senator Reingold, I'll ask you if you care to make some closing statements before I set Senate Bill 119 aside.
We swear to take and uphold and defend it. I just think we need to read it and make sure that those three documents are read together. And with that, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Reingold. At this point, we will now set Senate Bill 119 aside. And is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is in 2 days on Wednesday, February 2nd at 1:30 p.m. We are adjourned at 2:58 p.m.